Missing minerals? 99% of us are. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps restore what your body's missing, naturally supporting mood, energy, and immunity. Get yours now at TraceMinerals.com.
Today's episode of Expanded Perspectives is sponsored by Gaia.com. If y'all are like us, you've exhausted everywhere else you find your documentaries on the strange and unusual and the fun. And if you like grand conspiracies and more breakaway societies, paranormal, ancient civilizations like we all do, and UFOs, well, we've found the place right at your fingertips, folks. You can stream videos from anywhere, from your living room or on the go, with access to over 7,000 titles, all on Gaia.com, G-A-I-A. Now, you can get this for a monthly plan of $9.95 a month. Your first month will only be 99 cents. Now, there is a three-month plan and an annual plan. So, if you're into the things that we're into, and judging by what you're listening to, you are, start enjoying Gaia.com. Expand your perspective even more. G-A-I-A.com.
And this show is made possible by Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country, and I love it. We've talked about it before. We'll talk about it again. They sent me my box. Most recently, I've done the burgers that they sent me. They also just sent me this shrimp etouffee. Me and Delee made the shrimp etouffee. I'm a big fan of Cajun food. Being right here in Texas, we're next door to Louisiana, there's a lot of Cajun food here in this state, and I loved it. It was so easy to do. Not only do they send you fresh ingredients, but they send you the step-by-step instruction on how to prepare the meal. And, you know, lots of times when I get a hankering for something, I'll get on Pinterest or I'll get on YouTube or something and I'll look for the recipe. Then I end up going to the grocery store, buying all these ingredients. And, of course, I make what I set out to make. But then I have all this leftover stuff that, you know, that I never need. Like I might care for a particular spice or something. And then that was used in that recipe, and I'll never use that spice again. Blue Apron's not like that. They send you the exact amount, not just the ingredients, but the exact portions that you need to create it, so there's no waste. And they've established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States. Their produce is sourced from farms that only practice regenerative farming. All their beef, all their chicken, all their pork come from responsibly raised animals. Their seafood is sourced sustainably under standards developed in the partnership with the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch, which is all very important to me. I hate this factory farming.
Yes.
What it does and things. These are their produce, their beef, their chicken, their pork, their food, fish, seafood, all comes from responsibly raised animals. Cam, can you tell them what's going to be coming up on some of the upcoming meals?
Oh, the week of the March 6th. If you're a two-people plan, I'm digging this idea right here. Moroccan chicken with prunes and brown rice. And I'm also really, I got two other things here. Chipotle glazed meatloaf, or you can go with spicy shrimp coconut curry. That's just three. But if the family plan, which is what I've got, I'm digging this right here. I'm looking, of course, the shrimp etouffee. But I looked at this. Soy glazed chicken with soba noodles, broccoli, and cashews, because last time I had the stir fry and it was amazing. So this is something that I'm going to look into right here. I think I liked it. And another thing that I like the best about it is when they give you the instructions on how to cook it, Gil gives you everything that you can keep. So if you want to go back, yeah, you can go back and buy it yourself later on in the grocery store and make it yourself again.
Yeah, it's affordable. For less than $10 a person per meal, they deliver seasonal recipes that are pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. I like the variety. You get to choose from a new recipe each week, and they're never repeated throughout the entire calendar year. It's flexible. I recently went snow skiing, and it was really easy to go onto their website, tell them I'm not going to be in town that weekend. That's fine. They didn't deliver it. The weekend I got back home, I got my next shipment. Preparing the meals, I can't stress to you enough, you may not be an excellent cook. It's really easy. Each meal comes with step-by-step instructions, like Cam was talking about. And every meal is prepared in under 40 minutes, and it's guaranteed. They guarantee their freshness, and they promise that when it arrives, it is ready to cook. I mean, the boys, they love cooking with me. They're just starting to get to the age where they're starting to learn how to cook. And so whenever the Blue Apron arrives, they get excited. They're like, cool, Dad, let's try to make this together. And it really is fun. Check out this week's menu, and you'll get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/expanded. And you'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredibly home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/expanded. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Cam, you ready to start the show?
Let's do this. Out there, friends, and thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. That's right, it's me, it's Cam, and as always, across the table, you've guessed it, he's back. We've got him back in studio. He survived, not casted up, not wrapped up, although he did come in here smelling a little bit like muscle creams and all that stuff. Tiger Balm is the Mr. Snowboard professional himself, Kyle Burton Filson. What's going on there, Philio?
Hey, everybody. I am so glad to be back in studio. I'm back from my world travels. I had a great week up in the mountains snowboarding with family and friends. And yeah, man, I survived. I didn't have any major crashes. I didn't get hurt. My legs are sore. You know, I'm not used to doing that type of thing. But no, man, we had a really good time. It was very warm compared to normal. I can't ever remember a ski trip being this warm, which is alarming because I think, I mean, it was not cold at all. I want to say like 40, 42 degrees during the day.
Wow.
I mean, I was able to snowboard with just a hoodie on. Normally, I'm used to, you know, in jackets or layers.
And yeah, you got
to
be wrapped up. Yeah.
You know, and I've definitely been in areas where it's been that warm, but not this early in the season. Usually that's later, like after spring break. But no, we had a good time. It snowed one of the days, and the other days were just beautiful. It was a good trip. It went by too fast, as you know, vacation often does. But it was a good time. What about you, man? What were you doing while I was out of town?
Well, I made mention of it on the Elite Show, and I went and did it, folks. This weekend, I went to a disc golf course, and they had a big tournament out there. And I actually hung out with the guys because we have a lot of friends that play, and they've talked me into playing. I didn't play this tournament, but I'm going to this week coming up. I'm going to venture out. I'm going to give it a whirl. It seems to be something I think I might get into. There's almost 100 courses less than an hour from where we live right now, and I think that sounds awesome. It's free to play. You get your discs. You go out there. You hum them around and bounce them off some trees and, you know, look for them in the tall grass, which is probably what I'll be doing a lot of. So this weekend was fun. That's what I did. Got outside, walked around, talked to some people, had a great time. The whole thing
that's
was
cool. I've seen the guys playing it. I've never even been on a course like that. And but hey, man, it looks like it's good exercise. Looks like it's fun. Get you outside. I mean, in a world like today, with, you know, Apple TV, Roku, Netflix,
Hulu, I ain't hating on any of that.
Gaia, all these. No, I'm not hating on it. I'm saying it seems like there's so much more you can do indoors that, like, I don't think enough people are getting outside anymore. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, everybody needs something. Just go outside for a little bit. You know, put those devices down. I have to get onto my kids. You know, they're constantly. Luke, you know, he moves from one device to the next. He's got his iPad out, and when the battery runs out of that, then he gets his Kindle. When that runs out, then he wants to get, you know, you're like, hey, man, we gotta start putting some time constraints on everybody in this house.
Yeah.
You know, put the phone down for a couple hours. So that's really cool, man. Disc golf, I hope you get into that.
I'm going to give it a whirl and see what happens, but like it does look fun.
I'll probably accompany you sometime.
Oh, yeah, you'll have to go.
See what it looks like. But let's get into the news. This first story comes from Live Science. It's about the world's rarest boa snake was seen for the first time in 64 years. Check this out. Brazil's elusive tree boa, or Corallus crapani, also known as Cropan's boa, is one of the world's rarest boas, infrequently sighted and known from only a handful of dead specimens that were collected after the snake was first seen and described all the way back in 1953. The species, however, turns out to be alive and well because scientists recently discovered one. They said one of those slippery serpents was captured in January, which is the second living specimen ever seen, and it's the first time one has been glimpsed in nearly 64 years. The boa was brought to local scientists by rural residents of the Ribera Valley region in response to an extensive outreach efforts coordinated by researchers from the Museum of Zoology of the University of São Paulo and the Bhutan Institute, a biological research center. It says that back on February 3rd, it was brought in. Now, this Cropan's boa is only found in Brazil's Atlantic Forest in a 116 square mile or 300 square kilometer region in Sao Paulo. It is the rarest type of boa in the New World and possibly the rarest on planet Earth, according to the International Union for Conservation of Nature and Natural Resources. Now, the organization classifies the boa as endangered because its habitat is restricted to one location that is declining in quality. And though the population size is unknown, the scarcity of the sightings hints that there probably are not a lot of these snakes left to even be found. Now, the first species was described all the way back in 1953 from a single adult male specimen. It says that the scales along its back were an olive beige color with dark brown spots that appear from the neck as far down as to the tail. According to a study published back in May of 2011 in the journal Salamandra, after that first sighting of a living animal, the only Cropan's boa seen by scientists, five in total, all came from the same Atlantic Forest region. And all of those were dead already. So this is only the second time that they've ever seen one alive at all. They only found dead ones.
Wow.
And so you're talking about a very small population of these snakes, very rare, that they weren't even sure that they were even alive anymore because we hadn't seen one alive in 64 years. And bingo, bango.
You got one.
They got one. So we talk about this all the time. New species being discovered. Also, species thought to be extinct are, in fact, extant. And it reminds me of, you know, like we bring it up all the time, like the thylacine.
Yep.
Just because there hasn't been one seen since the last one in the Hobart Zoo does not mean that there could not be one still alive today.
Like a little pocket of a few of them out there.
I think so. I'd like to believe so.
Of course, I understand, too. Snakes are harder to probably find than thylacine, but still.
Sure.
It's one of those things that I still hold out hope. Hold out hope that we'll come across something like that. I've got something interesting here because we always get emails, tons of emails and messages how much that all y'all enjoy the intro music to the show, which we appreciate so, so much. Derek hooked us up with that whole thing. If you haven't already checked out Pretty Lights Music, well, you yourself are missing out. But this actually comes from Popular Science, and I thought this was interesting. It says, yes, good music kind of gets you high. Your favorite tunes activate the same brain systems that opioid drugs do. It says at the end of a stressful day that you pop on a pair of headphones, you hit play, and then put it on your favorite song, and your mood instantly improves. It says this emotional response occurs by a new study that suggests this, that the music activates a chemical reward system in your brain, the same system that makes yummy food or vigorous exercise and opioid drugs feel good. Yeah, that's right. Music is a drug, folks. Some researchers, they said to study this, these researchers started surveying people's feelings. So much so that they did this. They scanned the brains of performers and listeners and even measured hormone production. And their findings suggest this much so far, that our enjoyment comes from the same two-phase reward process. A dopamine-driven phase followed by a dopamine and opioid-influenced phase. And this is what it kicks into gear. Basically, it's like this. Like when you eat a tasty treat or you experience like an adrenaline rush like you would from an intense workout, that this neurological reward system gives this drug for this appeal to basically want you to do this more. So it's a way of, you know, the reward system to trick your body into this being the right thing. We always talk about it's the way that the reason you look at the babies, the way you, when you see a baby or you smell a baby, most people have that triggered response of, oh, it's a baby. The reason they do that is so you don't throw the baby away, you know, when it gets to be a pain like sometimes they can babies be. It's a trick to your system. And that's basically what it is. There's a new study in the Scientific Reports that tested the effect of this. It's naltrexone. naltrexone on this musical enjoyment. Now, this naltrexone is this. It's basically the effects of this drug that block opioid receptors. It's this naltrexone. And they discovered that the blockers do indeed reduce the feelings of pleasure or physical activity after eating and all this. And they said that they're going to use it as a potential for treating dependence on alcohol or drugs. So they use this effect on there to check this out on musical enjoyment. They had 15 students choose two pieces of music that they loved, songs that made them feel good, like give them chill bumps type feeling, you know, like woo, and they put them in a lab. The subjects received either naltrexone or a placebo, and an hour later, the students listened to their chosen music. It says, as well as two neutral songs that the scientists selected. Well, as the music plays, the students use this slider to indicate their current level of pleasure, and sensors measured the electrical activity in their facial muscles. So what do they do? A week later, after they go through this whole thing, they did all the surveys, the subjects that went through the same thing a week later, this time with the naltrexone group receiving placebos or vice versa. So they just flipped them, right?
Right.
So they go in there, they go through all this. We're going to crunch these numbers. They're going to crash them down. They're going to find out. They found that participants moved their facial muscles less with naltrexone in their system, indicating that it had reduced their emotional response to what they were hearing. This went for both positive and negative emotions. The highs felt lower and the lows felt higher. So basically, it's leveled you off when they use all this. So they believe that they're going to be able to use this, of course, like we talked about, for a drug thing. But what's really odd is that they used music. That music actually releases that feeling in our body. So it's, you always think about it when you're watching a movie. You imagine if you mute something. So next time you're at home and you're watching one of your favorite movies and you know that it's coming up, just mute it. Just click the mute. Don't listen to the music. You'd be surprised at how less exciting that part of the movie is.
Yeah.
Because you don't have that music pumping you up. Like in a horror movie when the music starts getting crazy and all that. They now know it's a real thing, a real effect, and they're even using that effect so well trusted to study these drugs and how they affect your mood so they can use that possibly to treat addiction later on down the road.
That is
crazy, right?
Cool. And speaking of crazy, I don't know if you're aware of this. Have you seen this possible reptilian photo that allegedly brings down 4chan?
No, but you got to tell me about it. Doggone it.
According to a number of reports, a photograph reputedly of a reptilian alien taken outside of Luke Air Force Base was posted to 4chan on Thursday, and within minutes, the entire website was allegedly taken offline, and all copies of the photograph mysteriously disappeared, except for one. Now, for those that don't know, 4chan is a highly controversial image board site associated with a wide variety of, you know, controversial, nefarious groups and famous for its pranks. But this picture from Luke Air Force Base, which is an active United States Air Force base located 15 miles west of Phoenix, Arizona, and this is where reptilians are alleged shape-shifting humanoid aliens who reputedly control the world from underground bases and are said to be related to most of the world's leaders. Now, you've heard of these stories. According to various accounts, an anonymous thread titled 24489, taken approximately 24 miles northwest of Luke Air Force Base, Phoenix, Arizona, lab known as H4C, this started on February 23rd between 12 a.m. and 2 a.m., and the post included a picture of an alien which was said to have yellow scales, black eyes, and small pursed lips, and was looking directly at the camera in a classic selfie pose. Reports say that the thread was only up for a few minutes before the 4chan channel went offline, and when it returned, all traces of the photo thread were gone. So I've taken a look here. I'll put links to it. You can take a look. It looks pretty creepy. I don't know what it is. You know, and even Paul Seaburn over at Mysterious Universe, who's a blogger over there, he wrote and he asked, you know, he said, was this a case of mass pranking by mass hysteria, an attempt to see how many people would actually fall for a crappy picture and a story about a reptilian photograph that brings down a website and makes those who see it ill, or are the reptilians trying to distract humans from paying attention to real issues? Are they attempting to get people so fed up with outlandish alien claims that they won't believe any of them, allowing the reptilians to do their work without suspicion? So it is a good question. I think about this all the time when it comes to this topic. Is this something leaked by, you know, a legitimate source, or is it, you know, more cover up? They're like trying to distract you, like we talked about the movie
or by Mark Pilkington.
You know, Mirage Men, where the guy was going out and feeding disinformation to keep you off the real issues. I don't know, but it's a creepy picture, so you should check it out. What do you think about the reptilian underrising?
I just can't get behind it. I'm sorry. I can't. I don't know.
It does
seem also hard. Another one of those things that's this. I'm not saying it's not real. I'm not saying it's not there. I just don't have time to look at all of it.
You know,
we do so much stuff already. I'm just now looking at disc golf. The last thing I need to worry about is getting into reptilian encounters,
you know,
right?
Well, you know, it's... You know, the truth is stranger than fiction, but it does seem odd where they start saying, well, these Hillary Clinton and stuff and these other high up officials are shape-shifting reptilians in control of the government. I don't know, man.
That was said by Kyle Filson, everybody. Kyle Filson no. said that. If I go missing, it's not me that said that, folks. I'm not looking into that. Kyle is.
I'm not looking. Kyle brought up her name.
Just, that's all Kyle.
I'm just reciting stories that I've read online and books and things like that. Who was the first one that started? David Icke. Wasn't he the first one that started writing about the reptilians?
I think so, but he's kind of distanced himself from the whole reptilian thing.
Yeah,
now,
I think so. Anyways, nonetheless, interesting photograph. Take a look. Tell me what you think.
I've got you something here that's interesting, Brad, and you've actually discussed this. This comes from my friends at CryptoZoologyNews.com. Jersey Devil photographed in Pennsylvania.
I saw this.
Right? A Pennsylvania construction worker says that he photographed an unknown creature that he believes, and I quote, had the exact marks, he says, of the Jersey Devil. 32-year-old fellow named R.W. told CryptoZoology News this past Friday that he was driving on the highway about an hour outside of Philadelphia when he and his friend spotted the creature. So what he says, I was driving back from Philadelphia. I don't remember the exact part I was in, but me and my friend were in the car and we saw what seemed to be a massive vulture in a tree. It was getting dark out, so we couldn't make out the features very well at all. And I told him to get his phone out for a picture. This says the Pennsylvania man said the creature began taking off from the tree when his friend took the photograph. The image, which is submitted to CryptoZoology News and seemingly taken from inside the vehicle, shows a blurry, rainy highway with a few blurred cars and a dark animal on the top left that's flying, folks. Now, this alleged animal appears to be less than blurry than the elements, let's say, when you see the picture and you start looking at this thing, like I said, you're going down the highway, you can tell it's traveling. It does seem to be a little more crisp around the edges of this photo than it does around the trees, the lights, the signs, anything else. But the man said the creature was very large and had bat-like wings and goat features. Yeah, he says this. It was extremely creepy, but we figured we must have just seen it wrong because of the rain and the darkness. But upon looking at the picture, it looks like no bird or bat I have seen before. So, it says the photograph was checked by an image analyst at CryptoZoology News, and based on compression characteristics and EXIF metadata, the image initially appears to have been processed or edited with a photo editor software. Now, of course, it says this happened. This is what he's saying. This photograph. Now, mind you, he's saying he just talked about this past Friday. He tells them, right?
Right.
But in here, it actually says that he said this alleged took place, this encounter, November 26th of 2015. So, I don't know why he waited so long if that's what it was when he saw it. You know what I'm saying? Because he just told him on this that it happened right. This past Friday. So, if this is what it is, I don't know why it's waited this long. But it also seems kind of strange that it says that it appears to have been processed or edited with a photo editor software. But that doesn't tell me anything. If it's coming from a phone, maybe he put it in his phone. Maybe he ran it through the phone editing software to try to lighten it up or you could see it a little bit better. Maybe he cropped it. Maybe he tried to stretch it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know what editing software he's talking about. But it is a very interesting story or photograph, rather. And if you go to look to it, folks, you can go to CryptoZoology News. You can check out the show notes and click on it and check this little link out. When you look at this picture, are you looking at this picture, Kyle?
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now.
You see its tail? How it looks like it's hanging down real low.
Yeah.
You see that? Like, it almost looks like a kite. It almost looks like you photoshopped a kite in that area when you see that tail hanging down real low. Because initially you don't notice it. You just look at the shape of the animal, whatever this thing is. But the tail is very long, and it almost looks like a long broom or like when they had multiple trailers, tassels coming out of the tail of a kite. For stability, that's almost what it looks like. I'm not saying it's not the Jersey Devil, but what I'm saying is that's a very interesting photograph, and then to see that part of it, and then to see that they're claiming that it was run through an editor process.
Yeah.
I want to know, and I guess I want to know why he's had this photo since November 2015, and this is the first time it's really starting to make its rounds. People are starting to, I see it. And what he claims has the exact marks. I don't see any exact, of course, what are the exact marks? We haven't really completely studied the Jersey Devil last I checked, but anyway, I don't know where he got the exact marks of that. Looks like a flying goat. Okay, looks like a flying goat.
Yeah.
Anyway, moving on from that, folks, before we go into break, for those of you that have seen what we were talking about on social media, the things we've got him here in studio. To my left-hand side, we've got Mr. Lyle Blackburn. For those that don't know Lyle or aren't familiar with him, of course, he's a cryptid researcher from here in Texas, an amazing author. He's also a musician. He wrote the book, The Beast of Boggy Creek. He wrote the book about the lizard man. His new book is Beyond Boggy Creek. He was also in the movie that Seth Breedlove from Small Town Monsters made. And he's also going to be narrating the new Mothman movie.
That's right, yeah.
Coming up. So Lyle is a busy, busy fellow. Been on tons of television series because of that, Mysteries in America. I mean, he's been on a ton of stuff, folks, and he's done a lot of this stuff. We're lucky enough to call him a very good friend of ours, and he agreed to come over, hang out in the studio, discuss this book, discuss some of the stuff he's had, you know, when he's on the show and or talking about in the movie and things like that. It was great. We had a wonderful time talking to Lyle. And I think you're really going to enjoy this. If you haven't already picked up the book, we'll tell you how to get that, of course, and all that stuff after the show. I think you're going to enjoy this. We had a great time talking to him. He's a great guy. So when we get back, folks, you're going to be listening to Lyle Blackburn talk about Beyond Boggy Creek. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
All right, y'all, it has just happened. We've been in here now for 30-45 minutes talking, telling lies, and we're actually gonna go ahead and go through with this. We've brought him back. He's been in here a couple of times, I believe, but now we're back in here talking with Lyle about his new book, Beyond Boggy Creek. That's right, he's here, folks. Mr. Lyle Blackburn. What's going on, brother?
Hey, not much. Here in the flesh.
That's right. We brought him back in. Woo-hoo.
Yeah. We like to have people actually in studio, especially those that live nearby, like Nick and Lyle. And so it's exciting. You know, once again, you've outdone yourself with this new book. If you're not familiar, he wrote a book a couple years ago called The Beast of Boggy Creek. And he's come out with this new one called Beyond Boggy Creek, In Search of the Southern Sasquatch, and it is awesome. It's jam-packed full of stories, and I love these eyewitness accounts. That's my favorite part. But Lyle, you know, he's not just scouring the internet for these stories. He's actually going and meeting with these people hands-on. A lot of these people are telling him firsthand accounts that, you know, were not shared other places. So I'd like to talk with Lyle today about this new book. Lyle, what inspired you to start to delve further than just the Beast of Boggy Creek?
Well, of course, you know, being a researcher of this subject, you know, for years I've, you know, read other reports, gotten other reports from, you know, all over, and especially in the South, you know, people read The Beast of Boggy Creek and like, oh, you know, I had an experience that, you know, it wasn't there near Fog, but it was over here. And, you know, so of course my files were building up, and I always really intended to do something more definitive for the Southern Sasquatch case. You know, there's really, you can't just pick up a book. You can find books that, you know, cover maybe one state or ones that mention stuff haphazardly, mm-hmm. you know, as the context of those books. But something that really just provided you the full history of encounters in the Deep South. And basically the concept of that was that, you know, my first outing with the Beast of Boggy Creek associated with the Legend of Boggy Creek, you know, that's one of the most famous, you know, cases in the Southern Sasquatch. And we think Southern Sasquatch, often you know, the Legend of Boggy Creek is going to come up. So I thought, you know, we'll start there, you know, with the premise that, yeah, that's the most famous case. It's sensational. It's awesome. It's been told. But let's go beyond that. Let's start going up the creeks and the waterways and the terrain and go from there and sort of map it out, you know, using the map instead of just state by state or anything, and just explore all those other accounts that you have all over the South.
Well, you've laid it out. Just, it makes sense now that you say that, because that seems the way it is. It branched out from there. It started going out and you started kind of tracing down. I'm guessing you probably had a lot of people at a lot of the conferences and stuff you were at come up and may have told you, I had this happen, or my uncle had this happen, or something like that. So over the last few years, I'm sure it's kind of compiled enough to where you're like, I've got to look into this. This is something I need to start chasing down. Because there was a bunch of them. A few of the stories, you know, like we've talked about, there's always a handful that are always at the top that everybody's heard. You know, everybody hears these and all this stuff. There's several of them, though, that I'm like, I've never even, you can tell it's a one-off story that they wanted to talk to you about, which is like what you and I was discussing before we even turned this on, was the account from the movie you made with Seth. Is, it's always funny to me, and this is what you and I was talking, not just the story, but how it affects the person that it happened to. Because you look at a lot of the stories, you can tell people tell them, and they've told them so many times that it's just like telling a story of going to work one day. Like, it's, nothing's really a big deal. But every so often you come across those gems to where you're like, what else could this have been other than what this person's claiming it to be? Because it has affected them. And especially after a number of years, as the one we were discussing, you go through all the whole circle of emotions, and you want to try to rationalize these sightings like you have in this book. If it was you that had the sighting, as something that you could scoff off, that you could be like, well, it was a bear, or it was a person, or it was something, because you want to rationalize so that fear is not there. But there's most of these tales, it only rationalizes down to one thing, and it's exactly what they believed, some sort of Sasquatch encounter. So let's talk about the one we were discussing off of the video. That's the one that you said, it's kind of what really you hung your hat on, that is, I know this guy well enough now to say what he had as an encounter.
Right. And yeah, you're right that those, you know, there's a lot of just passing sightings you can mention, but there's those that have substance to them. Mm-hmm. And those are the ones where you've talked to the person, maybe on more than one occasion, especially if you can meet with them in person and discuss that. And there's more to it. You know, you can see the effect it had on them. You can put it in context as to where they reported seeing this. And the one you're talking about was a young man who had an encounter in 1981 near the Boggy Creek area. And I count that one as my top sighting. His name was Terry Sutton. And everything came together for that particular one, because not only had I did he have a good story, he saw it up close within about 60 feet. He was on a pond fishing at the time on his own property, so that makes sense. He was quiet as to why the creature didn't see him and walk by that close. It was in an area on his own property, so you're not going to have hunters. You're not going to have the possibility of somebody dressing in a costume or anything like that. You know, if they were doing that, they'd be running across the road somewhere, not walking back deep into somebody's property. And as well, I talked to the witness and met him and his family as well, and I got to be friends with his father. That's how I knew about it, and then I contacted his father and got to be friends with him. He's an upstanding, well-respected citizen, just great, down-to-earth, honest people. And then you put that in the context of what Terry was saying, that he saw this creature late one evening as it walked up along near the pond up and over a bank, and it never saw him. He had a great view of it kind of from the side profile, and you know, he described it as, you know, something that wasn't human. It was covered in hair, it walked upright, it was you know, maybe 7 feet tall. Great view. And so everything came together for that one, other than me being there seeing it. Mm-hmm. As well, I mean, but minus that, completely, you just have those cases like that. You just simply can't explain what they saw, but they saw it. They saw something.
60 feet, 20 yards. I mean, that's close.
Yeah.
60 feet is very, very close. And like you said, he's sitting there staring right at it. To branch off of that, there was something, I guess when you read a book, there's always books that talk to you. You're always like, oh, I can really relate to that part. Page 134 in this book, hit me and reminded me of something that I've totally forgotten about. I even marked it again today because I'm like, I've got to talk to Lyle about this. When I was a child, I'd forgotten about this till this book. When I was a kid, my father would tell me stories of the Caddo Critter, but it wasn't in or on Lake Caddo. It was in Caddo, Texas, out near Strawn, when they had sightings and things going on out there. And he would tell stories. And I used to always ask him as a kid, I go, was it real? And he would tell me, no, I think it was a guy in a coat. It was just a dude in like a, he was dressed up. I've looked and looked and looked and tried, and I can never find anything about any of the stuff that happened. Everything still seems to point to the lake. This really hit home for me, though, is for the stuff that you opened up about all this and with the talking about the sightings at Caddo on the lake and all the things around that area. I don't know. I don't even know where to go with it. It reminds me so much of a childhood that I want it all to be. I'm like, it was right there by me too.
Yeah.
So I'm always thinking, was it a thing that my dad had heard that maybe he played off of what this was? Or was it something that really happened where there was real sightings there close to us as well?
There was. That's the thing I unraveled. I mean, as I look at, and that's one thing I try to do in my books is be as accurate as possible, because I look and there's been so many retellings and this and that and misinformation that I try to do my best to dig into the case. And there's certainly the impression of the Caddo Critter and something they called at Caddo Lake was Far East Texas. There is that, but there were sightings at Caddo, Texas, which is more in the central part of Texas, that kind of coincided with another accounts in Hawley, Texas, near Abilene. So yeah, there were sightings there, which are more rare, obviously, mm-hmm. in the central part of Texas, because it's not as forested and swampy and all that as East Texas. But yeah, you're right. Your dad wasn't making that up. There were sightings and people were reporting that. This was going on maybe back in the 60s and 70s. So yeah, it's...
Well, he had had friends that had actually had these sightings and when it had come up. And that's what was funny is, of course, you know, being a kid, I'm talking, I was probably 7 or 8 years old. And you run around the woods and all that stuff. And for those of you that aren't familiar with where Caddo and Strawn and all that, where we're talking about, it's very rough. Like we talked about the lake at Possum Kingdom. It's very rough, hilly, just tough country. And it's all cedars. It's a lot of cedar trees. And when we say cedars, we're talking, what, 6-footers, 7-footers at best would be out there. So it's a lot of scrub brush, mesquite, and cedars and real rough. So if something's out there, it's thick. It's thick, but it's not like the trees you would find in East Texas. But he was telling me that, and I'm like, Dad, there's nothing like that out. And he's like, no, people saw it. But he always told me that his idea was it was a guy in a suit. But I could never find that. I could never find anybody to verify that that's the story that it had come up with, that it was actually a guy just messing around.
Yeah, well, it's always a guy in a suit, supposedly.
Right, exactly.
Every one of these
exactly.
cases. Like, man.
When you start thinking of Texas, the pocket, if you were to say up, you know, up near the Arkansas border, or would you pick it, say, further down into the Sam Houston or down into the National, is there a pocket that if somebody wanted, say, themselves to go look because of the stories that you've compiled, is there a pocket in Texas that you would say is your hot spot?
The Sam Houston area has a high number of sightings. I mean, that is one place that would be convenient for a lot of people to go, to access that, reasonably, that has, you know, the reputation of a hotspot. Yeah. Sam Houston National Forest, that area in there real thick. Because if you look at the three counties that fall into that area, I mean, there is just a ton of sightings. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but certainly, you know, East Texas has a lot of, you know, hot spots as well, and Caddo Lake. It's just the more you dig, the more you find a history of sightings all up in there, because it's just thick country out there. And what people don't realize, not what they envision as Texas.
Exactly.
The scrub brush area where you're talking yeah. about, you know, we hunted a lot at Possum Kingdom mm-hmm. when I was younger. And I tried to dig up more sightings on that, and there have been a few. And I had a friend who was on a Boy Scout trip out there when he was younger, and they found this huge hand and footprint on a bank. And it was weird because, you know, he didn't really put it together at the time, but he remembered the scoutmaster was like, oh, They're like, what is that? Is there somebody out here barefooted? He's a huge dude, you know.
Yeah.
The scoutmaster, you could tell, he could tell he got kind of nervous, and it just, well, I don't know about anything. And then just got out of there. We're just, hey, we're going to go on a different part of the.
Funny how that always works out like that, isn't it?
And,
You've been doing a lot, and even from a few years ago, up around Caddo Lake. Is there a sighting from Caddo Lake that you really enjoy, that you've actually set, you know, like we've talked about and done it? Is there one there that you would like to say, look, this is a pretty good sighting that would take place there that I kind of lean on this one too?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, another one of my, you know, what I would consider top sightings that I've investigated as far as being credible and plausible occurred there back in the late 60s in the Caddo Lake area. There was Here's another one. Like, I met this girl, and she had seen that I go to Caddo. We'd done a Bigfoot conference and this and that. And she goes, oh, yeah, my dad grew up on Caddo. Love it out there. And, yeah, he had something really weird happen when he was a kid. So then I'm like, well, I got to talk to your dad, of course.
Score.
You know, this is getting good. Talk to him. You know, hadn't told his story to anybody. He's like, you know, just, you know, never really attributed necessarily to Bigfoot or anything. He's not into the subject. He said, well, here's the facts. And he and his brother used to go way back up in there. I mean, this was back at a time when, I mean, it's, you could still go in there and not, you know, there's nobody back there. But, you know, back then it was just remote, rugged, swampy area. And they were back there spending the night, and they had caught a bunch of fish and cooked them up and, you know, thrown the cleanings over there somewhere. And they had built a little shack or treehouse thing where they'd sleep, because they'd go back there for days, you know, and, you know, they'd sleep there. And, I mean, that's what kids did.
Yeah,
back
exactly.
Then,
yeah, know? We used to. Kyle and I did.
And so late that night, he heard something outside, you know, which is not unusual. You got the raccoons. I mean, it's, you know, but he did kind of get up and look, and look through the boards there, you know, not a very well built sealed up shack. He could see right through there. He looks out there and he sees this, you know, silhouetted figure in the moonlight, something huge. And at first he thought it was a person, which would have been extremely, you know, that would have been scary unto itself. Then he could realize it looked fuzzy and hairy, and it was just huge. It was big, and it was digging around in the, you know, the remains of the meal and the cleaning and stuff. And, you know, he watched it for a moment and then tried to wake up his brother. And then in the process of that, his brother starts getting up. And I guess, you know, the creak of the wood or something, the creature then looks up and could tell that something was in that structure.
Mm-hmm.
Looked right at him. And he said it just stood there a moment and turned and just boom, took off, ran through the brush and disappeared. Well, of course, he, you know, too scared to get out of
yeah.
there. So I don't think I slept the rest of the night, but the next morning went out, looked, saw some very strange, you know, human-like footprints with five toes, but they were, you know, extremely huge. He could see where the thing had busted the branches and run off. They sort of guesstimated the height that's about 7 feet using, you know, a tree that where he was standing by that. And he said, you know, the weird thing was this footprint. He goes, I can distinctly remember that it had a really large big toe. Big toe was huge. He goes, I don't know. I don't know what to think about that. I said, well, that's even more intriguing, because I've got other reports around the South and specifically along the Sabine River, which is not far from there, in which the same traits have been reported. It's like a Bigfoot track that has a really big toe.
A predominant
See, and
big
this
toe.
Is something that the guy
how would that
would
guy
not have known to tell you that.
Yeah, how would he know that? He there's no way. And then, you know, I'll look in some of Meldrum's files, and, you know, there's another one there from another part of the country. And, yeah, there's no way this guy could make up those kind of details. And, you know, I can, you know, this, again, he's not trying to be on TV. He's not down
exactly.
at it. He's not, you know, emailing every Bigfoot organization with his story.
You wouldn't even have known about it if the girl hadn't told you about her father's story.
Yeah, he wasn't coming yep. forward. He was just like, it happened.
Well, the same thing exactly. with Terry Sutton. I mean, he yeah. wasn't seeking Lyle out. You had to almost,
yeah.
you know, kind of boogie your way in there to get him to tell you the story.
And that's the ones I like best, and I think have a high, you know, rate of credibility, because it strengthens the case. I mean, you know, a lot of times I hear good stories and a person, oh, you know, this happened. And then another incident happened. Oh, wait, and I was in another state and I saw one. And then I was in three other states.
Yeah.
And it starts to unravel. But these witnesses are, you know, there are people not looking for Bigfoot. They were just at what I consider the right place at the right time, but maybe to them, the wrong place right. at the wrong time. But they're just your average person who encountered something unexplainable. And, you know, how do you explain that?
Exactly. And you're 100% right. I'm the same way. When somebody has a one-time sighting, to me, it's much more believable than these people that supposedly have these habituation sites, you know, where they've got them coming in constantly. And I'm like, well, if you have them there all the time, couldn't you get a biologist, a zoologist, or somebody to come out there and do some investigations? But it almost never seems like it's real to me, where these one-off sightings, to me, seem very plausible. And speaking of other states other than just Texas, I was reading in your book, and there was it was called the Casino Creature. Now, I've heard about that story before. Could you tell everybody about the Casino Creature and what was seen at that casino up in Oklahoma?
Yeah, that's a good one. And another one that, you know, in a sort of a seemingly unsquatchy area, if you will, although, in fact, Oklahoma rates up there near the top with numbers of Bigfoot sightings, and mostly occurred in the south, southeast, you know, eastern portions of the state. But in this case, back in, I believe it was around 2000, there was a Native American casino in Oklahoma. There's many casinos, and they're run by the Native American, the tribes folk that live there. And they had caught something on a security camera out back, and it appeared to be this huge bipedal creature that came up to a grease trap there. And there was like an old mercury lamp that illuminated it. And so, you know, they got this on film, and of course, you know, word sort of leaked out and that sort of thing. And eventually some Bigfoot researchers that I know went up there and investigated it. And one of those guys was able to actually view this tape that they had recorded. And, you know, in his estimation, again, he just couldn't explain. It didn't look like a person. It was too big. And, you know, they used some measurements based on where that light was and the grease trap and everything else, and couldn't quite rationalize it other than, you know, this was a Bigfoot. And, of course, you know, you start talking to people around, and there had been other sightings. The guy who drove the bus back and forth to drop people off at the casino had seen something, and, you know, other things. You can kind of build the case. And unfortunately, ultimately, as these things go, that film ended up disappearing, basically.
Well, that's what I like about the story, is they didn't try to sell that video off to these news outlets or whatever. It's almost like the whoever's in charge of the casino, they saw it, they viewed it, they only allowed your friend to see it and maybe a handful of others, and then they just kind of buried it.
It was done,
which is really interesting.
Yeah, they you know, they didn't want the negative publicity in some ways. They didn't want a bunch of people tromping around up there on their property. You know, they're private with their lands and things, and they felt like that. I suppose they felt like that people would, you know, come around there and start Bigfoot hunting and stuff. Although, on the other hand, you know, that could be huge business for the casino. But I guess they just viewed it as, well, it's not what we want. So they didn't want the press down there, even though the press did show up. Word gets out. Press showed up. And then eventually just decided, we're not going to release this. There was an inside guy who had worked in the part of the camera security operation at the casino, who was actually, I think he was going to try to get a copy of that and get it out of there. And then suddenly he no longer works there, and he's moved to Canada, you know, to make the case even more weird. It's
right.
Like,
isn't that crazy?
And no one, you know, no one ever saw the tape again. So who knows if it still exists, but in fact, you know, the investigator, Roger Roberts, he saw the thing. He saw that tape, and, you know, they rewound it maybe 7, 8, 10 times. And so at least somebody had eyes on it from the outside. But other than that, another strange disappearance.
Well, I know there's a reenactment of it you can people watch on YouTube. We've talked about it and all that. And I've got a friend of mine that's a Native American, pure 100% Native American. And he told me, he's like, it doesn't surprise me at all that they would do that. And I said the same thing. I go, but wouldn't it make more money and all that stuff? He goes, there's a point, at least in his belief of his people that he called it, and that's where they're from, is up in Oklahoma. He was like, we make money one way, but he goes, there's a point that no matter what we do, we can't outgrow that we can't turn our backs on that. That that's something that he's like has been in our folklore and our belief system for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And if we know it's there, we're not going to exploit that. That's something that we don't. And he's like, so mm-hmm. he goes, it doesn't surprise me at the least that they were like, okay, we know it. We've always known it's there. Now y'all know it's there. Now leave it alone. And then it's gone. And that was the whole thing.
Yeah.
And he's like, so it doesn't surprise me at the least.
Yeah. That seems to be a lot of the attitude that they have, a different mindset than some of us have about the subject. Yeah. They're very much like, yeah, this is, we know about this.
We know it's real.
So. And we're not going to exploit it. So that makes sense.
Yeah. He was dead set on that feeling. And I was like, man, you know, that's, I got respect for that. But it doesn't change the fact that I want to see the video.
Yeah, that's why I like that story, because I've always liked, there's actual video of the thing, you know. How
Please.
Many other chances out there are there videos of such, you know, alleged creatures? Moving on to another state, the great state of Louisiana and other states. One of the stories you talked about in your book, I've actually heard before, and it's the you know, most sightings of Sasquatch, people just kind of see them. Or they're peeping behind a tree, or just, you know, casually washing something in the river, and then they kind of make their way off. But there are those stories where Sasquatch seems a little bit more aggressive. And one of my favorite stories is the one with Mike Woolley.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pretty scary story. I think most people are familiar with it. But how did you meet Mike? You know, how did you get in contact with him? And what was it like talking to him? Because I love the story. Let's listen to it.
My name is Mike Woolley. I'm from Keechaw, Louisiana. I had an encounter back in December of 1981 with a Bigfoot while deer hunting. It was a beautiful December day, perfect weather for a hunt. Temperature was about 30 degrees. I got to my deer stand that evening about 3 o'clock, got on it. And I was sitting there and I was facing to the north. And my deer stand was located about a mile and a half down an old logging road and off the main highway, secondary highway. And what I would do, I would park my truck halfway down the logging road and I would walk in the rest of the way because I didn't want to drive my truck down and spook the deer. Well, it must have been, I hadn't been there no more than 30 minutes. And this little young doe deer come running from the east out of some briars and brush that there's no way a human could walk through that. But she come up to my deer stand, and what was so amusing, come up to my deer stand and laid down, up and actually touching the deer stand. She was wringing wet with sweat. She had been run. Something had been running her. And I first thing hit my mind, it was a big buck. And I said, I'm going to kill me a big buck. So when I raised my head back up, I was turning my head, and out of my peripheral vision, I seen something hop to a tree. And it was tall, about 7-8 foot tall, and it was black, real hairy, like a gorilla. And I knew it wasn't a gorilla because there was no circus in town, and I knew it hadn't escaped, and I knew we didn't have no gorillas running loose. So the first thing hit my mind, it was somebody dressed up in a suit trying to scare me off my good deer hunting spot. Well, I go to talking to this thing, telling it, you know, take the head off, get out of here, you know, don't come back. You know, this ain't no joke. I don't find it funny. You know, just leave. Well, this thing was just eyeballing me, you know, looking at me and really giving me some sinister looks. And I knew right then, I said, you know, something ain't right. Well, this went on for a few minutes, and he must have been about 20 yards from me, 15, 20 yards. So I take my rifle, I've got a high-powered rifle with a high-powered scope on the rifle, and I look through the scope at the creature, and I knew that after looking at it, I was in a situation because it was cold, you know, the moisture was coming out of its mouth, its nostrils. It looked really, really human. The face was human. The eyelashes, I could see the eyelashes, you know, the eyes. The teeth were big, big teeth, flat teeth like our teeth. So anyway, I'm sitting there and I'm looking at it and it's really PO'd at me. And it lets out a roar like a lion. Well, about 100 yards to the northeast, there's this really, really loud whistle comes back. you know, a signal to the growl. Well, this creature looks over that way and whistles back in the same tone of whistle and then turns and looks at me. Well, I'm kind of like, hey, you know, what's going on here? You know, something's up. I'm in trouble, big trouble. Well, all of a sudden I hear movement coming from that direction, and I knew whatever he signaled was coming to meet up with him. And I knew that I was probably going to be the one going to be on the losing end of the stick, you know. Well, I thought it was a feral human because I'd heard about them, you know, done some reading about them. But so far as a Bigfoot, I thought that was something that existed out in California. I just thought that was something somebody made up to make money off of. Well, I jumped down off my stand, and I'm running to the west to get to my truck. And I look over my left shoulder, and this creature is running through the woods, and it is just moving brush. It's running through the brush, and it's bulldozing the brush down. And I knew, man, this thing is going to get me. It is mad. It is PO'd. It's going to get me. Well, I'm coming up on my truck, and I'm thinking, well, I got to stop to unlock my truck. And when I get ready to unlock the truck, he's going to make his move. He's going to have me. Well, something crossed my mind to fire a warning shot. Well, when I got to the tailgate of the truck, I threw my rifle to the left, pulled the trigger, and the shot fired, and the bullet hit about 7 foot up in a tree and blew bark in front of his face. Hit him in, the bark actually hit him in the face because he was about 3 foot from the tree. If the creature would have been another 2 seconds, the bullet would have hit him dead in the head. Well, I got in a truck, I'm driving off, I look in my rearview mirror, and lo and behold, his buddy that he had signaled had been tailing me coming up the logging road. I didn't have but one chasing me, I had two. Well, they kind of stood there and looked at each other as I was driving off. But my recommendation to anybody, if you ever have an encounter in the woods, is don't fool with them, don't make eye contact, don't point, and surely don't point a gun. Do not engage this creature, because if you do, you will lose. The reason I didn't shoot it is it was just too human. The face, it was a bipedal, you know, it walked on two legs, just like we did. But it was just too human. The face was too human. The eyelashes, the teeth, the jaw structure, the forehead, it was light brown. The face was light brown, like it had a dark suntan. But I couldn't pull the trigger because something told me this ain't right. It's not the right thing to do.
Now that we're back, I want to know what you thought, how you met with Mike, and when you spoke to Mike, what were your impressions of the story? Because, I mean, it is an incredible tale.
Yeah, definitely. It's one of those that stands out as one of the more scary Sasquatch encounters. I'm trying to think where I first met Mike. I've known him for years now, ran across him years ago, and, you know.
He seems authentic, man.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt this guy is a skilled hunter. He spent his life, you know, in the woods. And, you know, he's got some strange things that have happened. And I think this being the kind of the center point of it, there's been other things that were not necessarily eyes on it and that sort of thing that you can conjecture could be the same creatures. But, you know, this is sort of his signature incident. And, you know, I've heard him tell it, you know, on several occasions, and it's, you know, it's consistent. You know, I've it's one of those where I'm lucky to have met the person and then been able to see him on occasion time to time. In fact, we talked on the phone the other day. I was talking about the book, and, you know, he just has been somebody who's, you know, I've gotten to be friends with. And so, you know, I can't explain what right. He saw, and, you know, but I feel like that, you know, that incident is something that happened, and he's very much affected by it. He's one of those that has been, you know, he's a tough guy. I mean, he's a hunter. He's not, I wouldn't say he's traumatized or anything,
right.
but he definitely has a whole different sense or feel when he goes in the woods that ever since that happened, you know, and it something chasing him out. And some almost what's scary about that one is the sort of concerted effort that the creature had. They didn't, you know, just, I mean, it could have just grabbed him out of the tree stand. I mean,
right.
done right there. But the fact that they just sort of stayed on the periphery and just ran him out of there, that was their purpose. They're not going to.
It was almost like they didn't want to attack him. They just wanted him to scare him out of there. Like, this is our area. Please get out of here.
They knew the scare works. It works. They don't have to be physical.
Yeah.
If you yourself are, it's like anything else. It's the pressure of it. You know, it's almost like the fear of even some people have of law enforcement officers. They don't have to do anything. Just when they're there, you're like, I better slow down. I must go.
Right.
That's that same kind of presence that they have there.
Well, that's why I was excited when Lyle included that story in this book, because I've heard of the story, but I didn't know that Lyle actually knew Mike. And so when I saw it in the book, I was excited because I know Lyle personally, and I know that he would not include anything in the book that he didn't think was 100% legit.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a very good bullcrap detector, and I can only imagine in his line of work, he must get thousands of stories, whether, you know, relayed to him through email or meeting people at these conferences or book sales or, you know, where he's doing lectures and things. So for him to include a story that incredible, and he actually knows Mike, I didn't know that, that's what really gets me excited. Are there any stories that you find that were pretty compelling that you did include in the book that you can think of?
I mean, I think most of the ones that I thought were compelling
you included
are included.
Okay. Well, what are some of the what are some of your favorites that you could maybe think of that we didn't touch on?
Oh man, yeah. There's it's just so full of amazing stories, and I need to start trying to mentally think of this list. But you know, one of the you know. And kind of springboarding off the legend of Boggy Creek, which kind of had reeled me in, which is one reason Mike's is cool. It is one of those, like, it has substance. There's you know, not just a brief sighting across the road. There's a big experience. It's scary. There's another one in there that it's kind of one of my that stood out to me. It was this happened in Mississippi, and the witness said that he was young at the time. They had the family pet had died, and they went off into the woods. They lived out there, you know, in a rural area. They went off in the woods and had buried the dog earlier that day, and up on a little embankment. And you know, later that day, he was feeling down. He was, you know, just bummed out. And he, you know, I'm gonna take my BB gun and go out in the woods.
Right.
Again, this is what kids
that's right
did or probably still do, but. You know, he's walking around down there, and he gets near the place where they had buried the dog earlier in the morning, and he hears something, you know, something moving, and he gets up to that spot and looks up on that embankment, and there is this ape-like creature digging where they had buried the dog. And the thing is, you know, just scraping at the ground. It's hunched over. He said he could, you know, it was covered in hair, and, you know, his mind, like, what can this be? And then, you know, he's there, and the thing stands up, and it's standing on 2 feet, and it looks at him. So he's down there by himself.
Wow.
It's a bummer.
With a BB gun.
The BB gun. It's a bummer day. He said he did raise up the gun, you know, and sort of, you know, it's your only, and that's what you do. I've got a gun.
I'm going to bluff it.
But yeah, he's thinking like, yeah, this is not going to be anything against this thing. And, you know, sort of aims at it and looks at it, and finally the thing ends up just running off, but, you know, running off on two legs. And, you know, at the time, you know, just scared him to death, and he took off out of the woods. And, you know, I don't know, it's just one of those that builds up that mental image of just this thing digging.
Yeah.
You know.
Man.
For a dead dog. That's the whole other thing. You're like, what is going on?
Super creepy down in a ravine in Mississippi, you know. you know, spooky down there in some of those bottoms in Mississippi, minus the giant ape, you know.
It's a flesh-eating monster that's digging a hole trying to pull up your dead dog.
Good stuff.
We have had on, and are friends with Mike Mays, the Texas Cryptid Hunter. And there's another thing that you cover in this book is the Area X there in Oklahoma. Because a lot of people don't realize that there's a group of the NAWAC, the North American Wood Ape Conservancy, and those guys actually have an area that they've been studying for quite some time, and they had something go on up there. Would you tell them about that?
Yeah, I mean, in my mind, I know you know, most all the members of that group and have for years. And they are very very detail oriented, very observant, going about their research in a scientific way. And so now Area X has become sort of legendary. It's a location in, I won't give you specifics, but it's in the Ouachita Mountains. In the Ouachita Mountains, go from eastern Oklahoma into Arkansas, which is a hotbed, another hotbed of real mountain monsters is what I call them. A lot of sightings up there. But Area X is something that they've been focusing in on for many, many years now, and have documented a whole list of amazing and incredible sightings. And one of those was, like three members of the group had a sighting at the same time. And these are three people that I know, not just three random people, but
you know them.
Highly credible folks that I trust. You know, if they said they saw something, they saw something. And I've been to Area X myself a couple of times. So again, you know, I like to speak from experience, and I, you know, not just describe this or just imagine it, but you know, I can tell you what it's like there and
the lay of the land. You've seen it, you know what it looks like.
Yeah.
And also, not to cut you off, but the group that you're talking about, it's not just like a normal group that everybody pays their $35 and you get to be part of this group. It's pretty much a closed group of guys that's what they do. This is kind of, it's not just like we could all go be part of Bassmasters or all go join NRA, whatever. That's not what this group really is. It's not like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You don't just sign up and get in. There's a process of
no
approval.
Decoder ring and nothing like that.
None of that, yeah. You know, and, you know, that helps keep the fringe out. And, you know, I mean, a lot of these groups, and I know a lot of them, they certainly have a, qualifications you need to meet to be in there, but at least as far as these guys, I know for sure that they're, you know, well-educated, well-meaning, you know, well-thinking kind of folks that are looking into this subject in a fair and balanced way. Mm-hmm. And the documentation for Area X, they've written a longer dissertation that's fascinating as well on all this. And of course mine is sort of the condensed version, the highlights and that sort of thing on some of the incidents that happened, so that it gives you everything in context of the Southern Sasquatch, because this is an important area.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that I love that. I've loved the stories we've spoken to Mike Mays about that. Yeah. He was the one that first, you know, told us about that area. So very exciting stuff. Speaking of exciting, other than the books, though, let's remind everybody that you did a movie recently, The Boggy Creek Monster, with Seth Breedlove and Small Town Monsters. You do the narration on that, and you meeting people there and interviewing several people on that show. That's really cool. You're working on a new movie with them, too?
Yeah, I'm going to stay with them going forward with the movies. We had a great time and experience working on Boggy Creek Monster, and so I'm executive producer of the Mothman.
Check you out.
Point Pleasant. I know, I'm like, wow, that sounds important. Right. I'm totally down for
that.
Did
you get a card made where you can just have your name with that on it too?
I should. It'd be easier to explain, like, because people ask, hey man, what do you do? Like, what do you do for a living? This is a hard one. Yeah, I'll just whip out the card. I'm an executive producer.
Right. Just leave it at that.
Yeah.
Just leave it. Not even put for what for. It's just your name and executive producer.
So, but yeah, it's exciting to work with Small Town Monsters. I love what they've been doing. And Seth, in many ways, is sort of the visual counterpart of what I've been doing with my books. And it all came together by, you know, examining the Boggy Creek case where, you know, here's the research I've done. Here's my witnesses. Here's this. And then Seth coming in with his cinematic vision and to, interview the witnesses and show the area and put this all together. So I'm real proud of what we did. And
so, it looked amazing, you know, man. It was really good. It was just as good as your three books that you've written that are all amazing. The Beast of Boggy Creek, The Lizard Man, The Bishopville.
The Lizard Man, I love.
You know, Monster
I
there.
I love that book.
And, of course, the new book, Beyond Boggy Creek. Do you have any lectures or anything coming up soon, someplace to be speaking at?
There's a huge list of things coming up. This year is just insanely busy. I'm doing a book signing thing at the Monster Mart in Fauk on March the 4th. I'll be at one of our local area, the Bedford Public Library, mm-hmm. in Bedford, Texas, near the airport out there on March the 16th, doing a free presentation. Like to give back to the community, you know.
There you go.
Ohio Bigfoot Conference this year. I believe that's May 20th, and then those are the most recent things. And then next fall, it's just like literally I'm all over the country. International Bigfoot Conference, Cryptid Con in Kentucky, then the Mothman Festival. So yeah,
well, that's good, man. It's good that you're staying busy. You
it's
know?
Keeping him out of trouble. That's what it is. He's staying out of trouble.
If people have a sighting of their own or would like to get in contact with you, what's the best way?
Just hit my website, LyleBlackburn.com, and you can, there's, you know, the contact information on there. And of course, that, you know, it has the list of where I'll be around the country. That way people can hook up and, you know, come out when you can, meet in person. I love to meet people and, you know, hear their stories, mm-hmm. and reflections and talk about, their own experiences. So, LyleBlackburn.com is the place.
I'm going to have to ask you this because I know people are screaming right now wanting to know. During this research run that you made for the last couple years of this, did you have anything happen to you while you were doing the research as far as even more? Because I know you've had some things happen in the past. Is there more that you can add to that you can say, all right, this happened to me while I was out there going and doing all this?
There was one that kind of stood out. I mean, there's obviously always something going on because I'm so much, you know, out there. Mm-hmm. But in this case, and just to clarify that, you know, I've never actually had a sighting myself.
Yes.
People ask me this, like, have you had a sighting? No, I have not seen anything that I could definitively say, hey, yes, I saw a creature like this. But during my research, I went to Florida. And I wanted to go to the Ocala National Forest. There's been many sightings reported there over the years, and it worked out to where I could go there and actually go into that environment, because I've been to Florida, you know, several times over the years. I've even been to the Everglades, but you know, I just wanted to, in the context of this book, people describe the skunk ape, and I mm-hmm. talk extensively about Florida and, you know, a lot of sightings there. So I was out there one night with my research partner, Cindy Lee. We did a lot of stuff on the Lizard Man, and she's kind of the East Coast partner out there for research. And we spent some time there. And one evening, we were camped out. It was actually a campground or something, but it was deserted because this was in January of last year, on like a Sunday night, nobody there, which was kind of spooky in a mm-hmm. way. And it was kind of misty, raining, and we were headed out. We were going to take a hike deep into the woods there, and we're walking by and down sort of in a wooded area cutting through this path. And all of a sudden we hear this, like, something. It sounded like something hitting a tin can, bing, 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 you know, something like that. I'm thinking, you know, there was a little, like, just a light mist. So I'm thinking, well, maybe it's raindrops, but it sounds heavier than that. Something more forceful than just little bits mm-hmm. of, you know, raindrop. But so I turned and we put the headlamp in there and got out my other flashlight, trying to see if there was something in there. And then I kind of had to step into the woods because it's pretty thick. And as soon as I did, something, boom, got up and ran. And I'm like, whoa, what was that? And then so I edged more into the forest, trying to be as quiet as I could, putting that light down there, trying to see it. And as I would, every time I would get in closer, this thing would run. And then I'm trying to hear it. I mean, you know, I've been out there, I've heard deer run and, you know, hogs and things. And it just didn't sound like something like
heavy.
That. It sounded heavy, definitely heavy. It was big, and it was just out of sight of the, you know, flashlight. So I kept going in a couple of times and never could put a visual on it, but my heart's pumping and Cindy's standing back up there, like, you know, probably freaked out. I'm down, way
you're
down.
You're going after it. It's back in here.
So, you know, I come back out and I'm like, what do you think? You know, I said, I never could see it. And she's like, I really don't know, but I could hear it. You know, definitely wasn't a deer because they're
light. Yeah.
They're light and they're gone, you know, like
small feet.
But I never, you know, never got a visual. But the weird thing was, as soon as we got back, there was no more noise, ting, ting, no more of that hitting on the
wow.
can. I'm like, Okay. Mm. And looked around, you know, and it's one of those things where, you know, hey, it's...
Was still misting. All that was still the same. But that sound was gone.
Yeah, that was... It had stopped. And, you know, who knows? I mean, you know, I'm not going to say that was a skunk ape. But,
right.
But you're...
But it was something.
You're there, and it's spooky. And when you're in those positions, you the thing is, you're like, man, I could just be inches from seeing this thing. That could be it. This could be the gold.
Where I could actually lay my eyes on it.
Yeah, man.
I bet you it's always with me, is you can hear the roar in your ears because your blood pressure's up, so it's roaring and you're all holding your breath. Yeah, it's right there.
Oh man.
Exhilaration, you know. And that's the fun of this, you know. You're just you're the mystery is just out of reach, and you're just, you know, you're always there, and there's these credible sightings that are going through in your mm-hmm. mind, and you're just you know, it's just that thrill of the chase almost.
Do you have plans to continue to keep looking and grow this book now to other areas, or to keep digging through the South, or do you have any plans to keep going that way now?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a list of book ideas, you know, and even a list of requests. I get book requests like, hey, you should write a book. You know, I could, I'm like, man, it's going to take me like, I'll be like 80 by the time I write all these books. But yeah, certainly. I mean, and I think my forte is the South. You know, people are like, hey, have you ever investigated the, you know, Bigfoot in the Pacific Northwest? I'm like, you know, it's great. I'd love to do that. And there's been tons of books on that. And for me, I like to be in the place, you know, I can more, do a better job of investigation where I can go to those places. And yeah. I think I love the Southern flavor too. That's just something that, you know,
I agree with you. And I think it probably opens up some doors. You being from the South, when you interviewing these witnesses from South, they feel more comfortable because you are a Southerner, you know, as crazy that is, there's still people that are like, well, you know, I'm not telling my secrets to no Yankee or something.
Exactly.
That still goes on, still especially there with older folks. So
any hopes? Well, any hopes of any more, anything with the lizard man? Is that just completely gone? It was just that little spot, and he's not flared back up again, has he?
No, not unless you count that
doggone lizard man
ridiculous photo that circulated a couple of years ago. I think it was on...
Wasn't it a slea stack? Was that what it was?
It looked like a slea stack. Exactly. I mean, it was like a clay, rubbery slea stack. Yeah. I don't know. It was a terrible photo, and that just...
I hold out hope for the lizard man to make his return.
Well, I've gotten some other really creepy lizard man type reports from other places.
We're going to have to wrap this up so we can talk to Lyle about this off air.
It never fails, because as soon as you put out a book, oh, you wrote that book, and then I get more stuff. So,
So Beyond Bishopville's next, folks. Be ready for this. Beyond Bishopville.
So you never know. So yeah, I've got to create a book idea. But I've got something in the works that's even more swampy Southern. It's, man, it's going in that direction.
Nice.
Where I can tie in some of these just more random things that I get that may not be, you know, a book unto itself, but things that a theme where I can play in all this other weird stuff that's been reported. And
the other accounts you've got.
And not necessarily just Bigfoot. You know, I mean, I'm obviously kind of love the whole subject of cryptozoology, and there's a lot of Bigfoot stuff, but, you know, I like to spread the love to the other creatures.
Yeah,
that is awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on the air with us today, Lyle, and coming in studio and talking about your new book, Beyond Boggy Creek. Go out there, pick it up. You can get it at his website, lyleblackburn.com. You can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, iTunes, or you can contact Patrick at Anomalous Books. You can get yourself a copy. I suggest you do that. Thanks so much, Lyle.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. I love having Lyle in. Every time I've spoken to him, every time we've had him on the show, he does a fantastic job. This book, this newest book, Beyond Boggy Creek, is a great read. I suggest if you're into Sasquatch or just into cryptids in general, you definitely pick up this book. Mm-hmm. You should get his other books as well, The Beast of Boggy Creek and Lizard Man, mm-hmm. The Bishopville, South Carolina lizard story of there with Scrape Ore Swamp. That's a really neat book, yeah, too. You know, and don't forget, like you talked about, he's in the documentary, The Boggy Creek Monster by Small Town Monsters. He does the narration on there, as well as, you know, just getting up and speaking with people in the area that had witnessed something in that swamp near and around Boggy Creek. I love his work. I love his stories. I love the encounters he has with people. And it's so, we're so lucky to have somebody like that who lives so close to where we do the show from, mm-hmm, that we can actually have him come over. We just got lucky geographically, I guess.
Yeah, right.
I mean, sure. What is your favorite story you took from the book?
I don't know that I have a favorite. I don't know that I could nail one down to this being my favorite story. I just appreciate, I mean, it's one of those deals that when we all got done doing the show, we all went and ate together. Kyle and I and Lyle all went and sat down and ate a late lunch and just hung out, talked more about the stuff. And then even things, you know, that we didn't even discuss on the show. We didn't even talk about a lot of the Sasquatch stuff in the book, just other angles of things and talking about it. And he brought up the fact of the stories. It's the stories that are the most convincing are the ones from the people that don't seek the spotlight. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I take away the most from this book, are the stories of people that don't seek the spotlight. It's not like they're looking to anything to gain. They almost themselves have to be talked into telling the story to start with. And I think that's the one thing that I take away the most from it, and what I appreciate what he did. Not to mention the cover art is amazing on this book. I mean, the whole thing draws you in. But Lyle's always been good with that. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah, the covers of all of his books have always been great. But it's just fun to not only get these, but to also know that they're close, because so many people, at least in the South, can't really relate. They have to find, you know, you think about the Pacific Northwest or Alaska or Canada, the sightings around this area. But when we start talking about stuff that happened here in the South, it's sometimes hard for us to imagine up there, much like it's hard for them up there to imagine what it's like down here.
Yeah, I just think there's several people from all over the United States, as well as the world in general, don't realize how swampy and forested, mm-hmm, the southeastern United States is, and just how many sightings of these, whether you want to call them skunk apes, Sasquatch, whatever it is, that the history goes back in every one of the southern states, and there's a vast amount of stories of this Sasquatch type creatures there. Mm-hmm. So it's not a new thing. It's not like some people in the South heard the people up in British Columbia and stuff talking about it and decided to copy that. There is a vast history of this being, yeah, a creature, whatever this is, in and around the southeastern part of the United States. And that's what I like so much about this book. One of my favorite things, like I talked about during the interview, was the story of Mike Woolley. I've heard that story. We've played it before on the show. And you want to, you know, but when I knew that Lyle had spoken to Mike, then I was like, oh man, that builds validity to me, mm-hmm, because I know that Lyle is a no nonsense type of guy. And if he knows Mike and he's comfortable with his story, then that makes me feel even more in shock about how terrifying that encounter must have truly, yeah, been. Don't forget, folks, you can go and pick up the book yourself. You can go to Lyle's website himself, lyleblackburn.com. You can go to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, iTunes, things like that. I suggest you get a copy of not just Beyond Boggy Creek, but also The Beast of Boggy Creek and The Lizard Man book. If you have a friend or family member that's into cryptozoology, that would make an excellent gift. Also, check out the documentary. Go to smalltownmonsters.com. They've got a couple movies over there, The Boggy Creek Monster, The Beast of Whitenhall, and The Minerva Monster. Seth Breedlove and the guys do an amazing job with their documentaries. I cannot wait to see the new Mothman that he's filming currently, that Lyle is also working on.
Oh, yeah.
That is going to be a good time. And don't forget about our sponsors, blueapron.com/expanded, where you can have these incredible, fresh, home-cooked meals delivered to your house, and you create them with your family. You cook them yourself from all these fresh ingredients, and it is delicious. I'm not just saying this because they're a sponsor. Everything I've had them deliver to my house and I've created so far has been wonderful, and I think it's because the produce and the meat and stuff is so fresh. That's blueapron.com/expanded. Also, our sponsor, Gaia.com. Don't forget, there is an interesting series over there called Truth Hunter with Linda Moulton Howell. You can go in there. They got about 4 episodes out so far. If you go to Gaia.com, G-A-I-A.com, you can watch the first one for free. And if you join the service, it's about $9 a month. You can get access to that, as well as 7,000 other videos and movies over there. Also, if you're into yoga, things like that, it's all on there, man. And they're about to start a brand new season of Beyond Belief with George Norrie. That starts on March 1st, so that's this Wednesday. You should go over there and check that out. That's GAIA.com. If you have any stories you'd like to share with Expanded Perspectives, you can email the show at expandedperspectives.com. You can call the show, 817-945-3828. And you can follow us on all forms of social media. And don't forget also, if you like Expanded Perspectives and you want more, there is more. You can go to Expanded Perspectives Elite, which is a completely different podcast. It comes out every Friday. And by joining that, it's about $5 a month. Well, it's not about. It is $5 a month. And you'll get an additional show every week, as well as access to our entire back catalog. Mm-hmm. And there's episodes there with Lyle Blackburn. Yep. I think last time we had Lyle, Micah Hanks, and Nick Redfern all in studio.
Yep, that's when we had them.
And that's only on Elite, so you have to be a member to get that. Cam, what do you got planned for your week?
Hard work, clean living, a little disc golf. And before we get out of here, a quick shout out to a Funky Town native who's going to be resting easy there. Rest easy, Bill Paxton. It was great to watch you in all the movies you were in.
Man, that's so
sorry that you're gone, my friend. He was a wonderful actor, and we lost another Texan, my friend.
Man, it seems like they're just dropping like flies lately.
Yeah.
Lots of deaths. Well, I hope everybody out there has a good week. Give somebody a hug. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.